This is a Stimulus Network podcast.
Hello and welcome to Eureka Nerd. I am Will, and I think my favourite villager on our Animal Crossing New Horizons island is Kabuki, the cat who's dressed up like a Japanese no theatre performer and signs off all of their speech bubbles with meow.
He's also got an alarmingly deep voice, which catches me by surprise every single time.
You see this little cat with a face paint, you think, oh, that's fun.
Hey, friends, welcome to the island.
And I'm Leah, and my favourite villager on our Animal Crossing New Horizons island is Peaches, because she was the first one to try on my Captain Marvel costume custom design.
We are very much playing to type in our Animal Crossing island. If you want a Dodoko to come visit and see the Captain Marvel designs and see all of our stuff, then drop a comment in whatever social media you're using right now.
My absolute favourite visit that we've had so far is one of our friends who is a fellow queer who turned up with the exact same pink undercut haircut.
It's like a badge. Can identify like, others.
Yeah, oh, this is how you know we gay.
Like I said, playing to type.
Also, I'm really loving the dressing up. Oh my god.
But anyway, for more on our Animal Crossing island, you're going to have to come see it yourself, because right now we have some science news for you, because the lockdown continues and so does scientific research. Speaking of the lockdown, we are all ideally staying at home as much as possible. We are all ideally not going out, not meeting friends, and not being all that social. We're doing the social distancing thing.
The important thing is, the more you stay indoors, the more likely we get to have Halloween this year.
We've already lost Eurovision and we cannot lose Halloween.
Exactly.
So, if you are feeling a little bit lonesome during all of this social isolation, then good news, according to the University of Buffalo, doing social interactions, even if you're doing them over the internet, even if you're not doing them face-to-face, even apparently if you're doing them by yourself, they still help recharge your internal social meter and help you feel connected.
Now, I really am struggling with the terms that are used in this press release, because they're talking about social strategies, be they the traditional ones of seeing another human being face to face and interacting with them, or non-traditional ones like cooking and eating a meal alone. Reading through this, I was struggling with how in the hell that counts as a social strategy. It does explain right down the bottom of the press release that these are the sort of activities that have in the past been referred to as social surrogates. Still don't quite understand how cooking and eating alone is a surrogate for anything. It is what it is, guys. Like, I enjoy it, but it is what it is. But it makes more sense of some of the other non-traditional strategies that are mentioned, like reading novels, playing video games, watching TV shows.
And I wish I had an answer as to why those terms are used and what they mean by it, but the paper's behind a paywall, and I cannot continue without research, without doing some internet black magic. So if anyone from the University of Buffalo, perhaps even Professor Shira Gabriel, who is the Professor of Psychology at the College of Arts and Sciences there, would like to reach out and let us know.
Just help us make sense of how it's social if you're doing it entirely by yourself. She's talking about people having a social meter, which isn't, you know, a physical, like...
There isn't a dial beneath your ear next to the walnut where we've identified that you keep all your feelings to say, oh, this is how tired I am right now.
Yeah, there's not like a church roof fund thermometer on your chest that fills up like a character in The Sims when you have a conversation.
Maybe that should be the fashion trend. Fall 2020, we are all carrying around a flip chart to say, I can deal with this many people right now. I'm used to just one. I'm up to three, and if you're over that, then I'm sorry. I just don't know. No, we can't. I'm sorry.
One of my colleagues' whole family has escaped to Devon, and there are 15 of them in what normally seems like quite a large house. So I think they all are doing fine on the socializing front.
And I bet they are not going to be wanting to spend this Christmas together either.
Participants answered a questionnaire about their well-being and social connections. The data suggests that those non-traditional social strategies, those ones that have been known as social surrogates, do just as much as the face-to-face stuff. Different combinations of things work better for different people. So, like, do what works.
Yeah, I think the answer there is personality. Introverts, extroverts, whatever it is that you do to refill your social meter, you can do that.
However you're doing this, it's valid.
So now you have some science on your side. The next time someone says, how are you spending your lockdown? And all you have to say is, well, I've read my favourite book and I have been to visit the Animal Crossing island of this podcast that I listen to. Hey, guess what? We're scientifically proven to help you feel good now. Can't take it back. Thanks, University of Buffalo. You're welcome.
I expect, yeah, listening to podcasts definitely counts, right?
Speaking of listening to the podcast, you might remember at the end of our previous episode, we signed off with a quick story about how when it comes to medical emergencies, people don't think they follow their gut. Well, on related research from the Ohio State University, you may know the best decision and not make it. Author Ian Krabjic describes in the press release that there's this tension between doing what you should do, at least from a statistical perspective, versus doing what worked out well recently. So there's kind of a bias towards something that happened to work out in recent history, even if, statistically speaking, it shouldn't have happened. So thinking of people in casinos who play a lucky number, who always bet on black, despite the fact there's no statistical advantage, or maybe even a statistical disadvantage to doing that, but they follow their gut in that kind of instinctual driven way again.
The people know the best decision in the headline of this press release, I'm not so certain about, because the structure of the study means that the better strategy to take in the game they were using in this study is in some cases effective only 60% of the time. And I feel like if nearly half the time it doesn't work, you're not necessarily going to make the connection that that is the better strategy. Unless you're in the habit of basically counting cards.
And the game that you mentioned is a simple computer game in which noticing and exploiting patterns could make them more money. The researchers were tracking the mouse movements to detect whether or not participants picked up on these patterns. If they picked up on the pattern of choosing the top left symbol and the bottom right symbol to get the biggest reward, then you'd think, stick with that. It works. It's worked in recent experience. It should statistically bear out that you keep doing this thing. But people seem to form and follow their own gut instinct about this clearly designed to be slightly biased test.
And they don't mention whether there was a difference in people using the more successful high reward strategy between scenarios where it worked 60% of the time and scenarios where it worked 90% of the time. But they do say that when it didn't work some of the time, they stopped relying on it very quickly.
As Krabjic signs off at the end of this press release, that it can be hard whether to judge you have made a good or bad decision based just on the outcome. We can make a good decision and just get unlucky and have a bad outcome, or we can make a bad decision and get lucky and have a good outcome. So, ideally you can find something that will work to get the outcome that you desire and not just have to sit gambling your time away at the University of Ohio.
I like the idea that a bunch of students in Ohio just went, oh.
This is not to cast aspersions on Ohio State University. I'm sure they've got lots going for them. I just could not point to Ohio on a map if I was paid to.
Is it one of the square ones? I feel like it might be one of the square ones.
If you're listening to this in Ohio and can point it out to us on a map, then let us know at Eureka Nerdcast at Twitter or / Eureka Nerd on Facebook.
I do know that Loveland, Ohio has got a frogman. Learn that on the Spooktator.
I was about to ask if it was on their Animal Crossing island, but okay, a cryptid makes more sense, yeah. I suppose.
The next story is one about creativity and reward, which is relevant to my interests. I like making things and winning. And the discovery from a neuroimaging study that lots of us, when we are creative, get a nice little ping in the reward center of our brain.
And I did check. I did compare the images in this press release to the one from a couple of episodes ago. It is quite close to where we said the feelings walnut is. I think our walnut theory of human emotion is starting to, like, build some real weight.
Making things pleases the walnut.
You have to satisfy the walnut. You must tickle the walnut to release the dolphins. More on where the walnut is later.
Or earlier. You can backtrack for information about the walnut.
More on this imaging later. But first, a quote from one of the authors. John Cunias, a professor at Drexel's College of Arts and Sciences and director of the Creativity Research Lab there, who says that the fact that evolution has linked the generation of new ideas and perspectives to the human reward system may explain the proliferation of creativity and the advancement of science and culture. It's mentioned in this press release that creativity is a very human thing, that it's something that we have kind of the luxury to indulge in, and it's not necessary.
Lots of species get along fine without creativity, so why do we have it? Which struck me as odd, because just because something isn't necessary doesn't mean it isn't useful. And did remind me of some evolutionary psychology type nonsense about the female orgasm being an evolutionary hangover because it's not necessary. And it's like, okay, but like the pair bonding that it promotes, if you have fun having sex with somebody, helps with, you know, raising the potential results of that sex. So it's useful, even if you don't need it to get pregnant. What the hell, guys?
The more I hear about evolutionary psychology research, the more I'm starting to believe that not very much of that is useful or essential either. Like, I'm sure some of you are good guys, but some of you just seem to be eugenicists.
Blatant misogynists.
Altogether, not fun people, and I've got a piece of paper to prove that you're academically qualified to be kind of a dick.
There's quite a few fields like that, though. I mean, philosophers. Is anything real? Does it matter? Get on with it.
Spoken like an engineer.
Well, I'm not one of those either. If you kick it and your foot hits it, probably exists.
If I kick you and you go, ow, you're real and I'm real. So...
good job, us. Good job, us. And I mean, really, even if we are living in a simulation, the experience we're having of life is the experience of not living in a simulation, of living in a real world. So we might as well operate as if we're in a real world. What difference does it make to you if your life is a simulation? Just get on with it.
If you can't tell the difference, then what's the difference? Anyway, the walnut.
Time to please the walnut by being creative.
The walnut is illustrated in an animation that comes with this press release, showing activation of signals in the brain across time and across space, and you can see the red heat of activity as the reward system goes ping when someone has done something creative and good.
In this case, solving anagram puzzles. They talk about the flash of insight being what precedes the activation of the reward center. But I can't help but think of when you level up in World of Warcraft and you get a big light show around your character and it goes ding, and then people in chat who saw you do it go, grats ding.
The brain is a Skinner box.
Kind of, yeah. World of Warcraft is a very good Skinner box. It's a very effective Skinner box.
And if the World of Warcraft is a simulation and it makes you feel good, then what if the World of Worldcraft is a simulation? You know what? No, this is for evolution.
You're stretching it.
This is for evolutionary psychologists and philosophers to get PhDs in, and I can feel jealous of. We'll move on to the slightly wibbly science of quantum stuff.
Slightly wibbly. That's generous.
Now, we've talked about quantum stuff in a previous episode. I think it was episode 25. That's off the top of my brain, with Dr. Kate Oliver, who is... done quantum stuff to a much higher degree, to an actual degree level degree, so they were able to help out. Please do go back and check that episode if you want to know more quantum stuff. But for this press release from the Rand Corporation, the wibbliness of quantum is now also tied into the wibbliness of, I think, marketing.
I mean, they're specifically talking about like the US government being prepared for quantum computers posing a cybersecurity threat, which makes it seem less like marketing and more like putting something out there so if the person who's making the decisions goes and doesn't do it, then they can go, well, we told you so.
Or they could see this press release and say, oh, we should hire the Rand Corporation to come do the blah 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 blah, which is my take from it. Also, I think the plot to Die Hard with a Vengeance with Timothy Olyphant is something to do with quantum cybersecurity. It wasn't one of the good ones, so I didn't pay that much attention. Anyway.
Either way, there's an awful lot of words in this that I don't entirely understand, but they are quite fun to say, because sometimes sentences that are so full of jargon that they don't make sense are fun to say. So the report says that the sooner an interoperable standard for post-quantum cryptography can be widely implemented, the more the eventual risk will be diminished. The whole press release is full of sentences like this.
A non-expert looking at this, my takeaway from that is, in the future, computers will be better than the computers that we have now. So if we have a standard for those computers now, we can figure out how good they are likely to be. So we can kind of expect how much gooder than the now is.
But also that those good computers in the future might be used to decrypt messages that are being sent now. So we need to, like, up our cryptography game.
We have to beat the future.
We need to up our encryption game so that future computers can't break the code. Which does sound like something out of a 90s hacker movie, as does quote from Michael Vermeer, lead author of the report and physical scientist at RAND. The United States has the means and very likely enough time to avert a quantum disaster and build a safer future, but only if it begins preparations now.
Averting a quantum disaster is the plot to surely like three or four Nicolas Cage films that have come out in the last 5 years. He's done some dodgy choices.
It is definitely the plot to multiple sci-fi stories, films, so on and so forth.
What was the one with Jake Gyllenhaal? On the train.
I'm the wrong person to ask about this, aren't I?
Another great quote from Evan Peet, a co-author of the report and an economist at RAND. I'm going to do the Hollywood voice for this. The advent of quantum computers presents retroactive risk, because information being securely communicated today without post-quantum cryptography may be captured and held by others now, in order to be decrypted and revealed later, once quantum computers are created.
I mean, I'm not sure how useful information that you're capturing now is going to be once you have a quantum computer. It really depends, doesn't it? I mean, if it's my texts, then have at it.
Imagine Google X uses all of their quantum advantage stuff to finally decrypt a message from WhatsApp and it just says, lol, butts.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you're going to like decrypt some stuff and it's going to be just my mate's sex life.
They are definitely going to decrypt a dick pic. Someone using a quantum computer will quantumly decrypt someone else's junk.
They'll be waiting for it to download and the resolution will come in, like when they increase the resolution on a crappy CCTV still in a CSI episode, and it just comes into view and they're like, oh, that's a penis.
That penis cost us $11.2 billion.
Is it worth it? No, no, it's a penis.
No penis is worth not few penises are worth much. Anyway,
we got really distracted from quantum computing by talking about penises, and I think possibly that suggests neither of us is particularly interested in quantum computing.
Which is a shame, because there's another story about quantum computing up next from Stockholm University.
But this one does talk about speeding it up using giant atomic ions.
Which is the plot to another sci-fi film.
I like the idea that they're big enough to like hold in your hand.
Like the giant microbes, the fuzzy, plushy ones.
Exactly like that, yeah. Yeah, you can hold the ion and it computes at you.
Goes beep, 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 7.
Exactly, like Star Trek, the original series.
Now, these aren't just any old ions. These are trapped Rydberg ions, which apparently can be the next step towards scaling up quantum computers to sizes where they can be practically usable, according to a new study in Nature. This study from Stockholm University has been conducted by a research group aiming to solve the problem using these Rydberg ions that are apparently 100 million times larger than normal atoms or ions. They are highly interactive and can therefore exchange quantum information in less than a microsecond.
Now, I do not understand any of this. I was trying to think of a way of like couching that, of making it. I get what an ion is. I get that this is something to do with quantum entanglement, where subatomic particles like talk to each other. But beyond that, I'm lost.
the release in nature of sub-microsecond entangling gate between trapped ions via Rydberg interaction isn't much more use. But they do say, apparently, that they've managed to produce a Bell state with 78% fidelity.
Whatever the hell that means.
Which, I mean, that's quite good fidelity, 78%. That's better than the 60% advantage, which apparently you're statistically better off following. So, kudos to them. And Igor Lesanovsky of the University of Tübingen does break it down into something a bit more hands-on when he says that our theoretical work confirmed that there is indeed no slowdown expected once the ion crystals become larger, highlighting the prospect of a scalable quantum computer. So, what they've got at the moment when it comes to quantum computers are not scalable and not practicable, but in the future, they might be. In the future, they might also be dangerous, which is why you have to secure your junk now, but these guys are helping make that future a possibility.
I think we should talk about some wetter science next time. I struggle with this. I struggle with physics. We know I struggle with physics. What is physics?
You're sounding like a philosopher now.
What is it, though?
If you would like to tell us what physics is, if you can help us understand Rydberg ions and how they get to be so massive.
Are they massive or are they just big?
Ooh, good question. I don't know.
I know enough physics to know that that's an important question to ask.
Please do reach out to us. We are at Eureka Nerdcast on Twitter. You can find us at EurekaNerdcast@gmail.com or on Facebook/EurekaNerd.
And if you enjoy the podcast and want to support us, help us offset the costs of hosting equipment and just reward us for spending time to talk to you, then you can donate to us via Patreon for ongoing contributions. We're still working on reward tiers for that. We're looking for input. If you have ideas.
If you'd like to tickle our walnut.
If you would specifically like to tickle William's walnut.
That's a different bucket here.
Talk to us. What do you want from us?
Also, don't forget to check out the rest of the shows on the Stimulus Network. You can find all of those at stimulus.network. We've all been active over the course of this lockdown. The Cosmic Shed just put out an episode about the Neverending Story, which definitely haunted me as a child, the whole bit with the sphinxes.
You know, weirdly, I think I've only watched it all the way through the once, but I've probably seen, like, bits of it a couple of times, and I should maybe rewatch it.
We should do that and listen to this episode of the podcast where they talk all about the makings and the behind the scenes and the science.
At the same time, so we can't concentrate on either of them.
But until next time, we will leave you with two quick pieces of research to tickle your walnut over the course of the next few weeks of lockdown, because who knows when this is going to end. From the National Research University of Higher School of Economics, how many children is enough? According to Russians, it's 2, unless you want fewer or more.
2, unless.
Likely 2. 2. 2?
You're giving yourself lots of options.
No, that's the finding. How many? If depends. 2.
And the National Research Council of Science and Technology have looked at some kimchi and established that the fermentation is due to lactic acid bacteria in the cabbage and the garlic and nowhere else.
You mean 2 of the 4 ingredients?
Yes.
I'm glad someone figured out that some of the ingredients in kimchi make it kimchi.
2 of them, not the other 2.
Half of them. 50%.
Yep.
A statistically even shot between which of these were to make it a kimchi. Okay, so now we've got beef with evolutionary psychologists, philosophers, physicists, and the National Research Council of Science and Technology in Korea. I think that's enough.
I don't think we have insulted them. They've got some kimchi. They've gone, what makes it go? And they've found out. Good for them.
And statisticians. I think that's probably enough for one episode.
Yeah, probably. And remember, if you want to start a fight, you can email us.
So, until next time, that's bye-bye from me.
And goodbye from me. Is it worth it? No, it's a penis.
No penis is worth it. Few penises are worth much.
Apologies to any penis owners out there who are...
If you've invested heavily in your penis, then I'm sure you have, like...
I mean, just anyone who's disappointed that we are mocking the potential value of a penis, but I mean we're both bisexuals. We both understand in theory that they can be appealing, but in practice it's just a penis.
What you need to do is invest in the quantum security of your junk now to stop it from being acquired now and decrypted later.
So probably just don't send dick pics, actually. People can only see your junk if they're there to see your junk.
Even if it's a social coping strategy that you are using to refill your social barometer or whatever the thing was.
You can send dick pics in letters, but you do have to have taken them with an analog camera as well to make sure it's secure.
Has to come with a sonnet to accompany it. I think that we should add that as a qualifier.
I'd accept a haiku. I will accept dick pics accompanied by haiku. That's not an invitation, listeners. I don't want to see your penis.
This podcast is brought to you by the Stimulus Network.